Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I'm Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamond.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you, Rob?
I'm feeling very aware.
Aware of what?
Aware that I'm being recorded.
Oh, God.
Yeah, because today's guest, his work looks a lot at surveillance and recording and the voice. So today I'm thinking a lot about the voice.
And your voice.
Yeah, not just my voice, but about how other people's voices can be recorded and the political impact of that.
The political impact of a voice?
Yes.
That's interesting, Rob. Do you think you've got quite a political voice?
I think I've got a glamorous voice. I think it's quite global. I think it's actually stopping people in their tracks occasionally.
Yeah, I agree. You do have one of them sort of voices that makes people just stop what they're doing.
And go, please,
shut up. Anyway, our guest today is really, really, really exciting. We're talking to him for the first time ever on Talk Art. Down the line, we don't have our guest in the studio with us. We are doing it from another country. Our guest is currently in Beirut, where he resides. And we're incredibly fortunate today to have on Talk Art the amazing artist,
Lawrence Abu Hamdan.
Hello. That was quite an intro.
You can talk now. How are you, mate?
I'm very good. How are you guys?
Yeah, we're doing good. We're doing good in London. How's Beirut today?
It's great. There's a madness outside. You know, right now we're having huge protests.
Oh.
Against the corrupt elite who've been thieving for far too long and expecting us to pay their bills, their thieving bills.
So what, there's riots?
They're not budging, so... Yeah. It's been now, it's the, I think, the 57th or 58th, 9th day. I can't remember exactly. But we're down on the streets. There's huge amount of tear gas fired for the first time last night and some rubber bullets. So it's really taking a turn for the worst.
Wow.
Up until this point, the internal security forces were more or less keeping the peace. Now it seems they decide that we need to be off the streets after 59 days or so. Yeah, so it's a terrible morning. And in my other ethnic home, a disastrous result this week as well. I don't mean to be so political from the bat, but some of us we don't have the privilege to not be. it's madness. So yeah, this week is crazy.
That's the thing about your work, Lawrence, is that you are proudly political with your art, whereas a lot of artists would kind of shy away from making an obvious true political statement. But your work, that is fundamental to you, your practice, right?
Yeah, I see art as a means to do that very clearly. I think it can do it in a very distinct and different way than you can on the news or you can in other forums. But I think for me, art is a way of making claims. It is a That's what I like to use it for. Without that, I wouldn't do what I do. So it's not like the work is political. It's that for me, art is really the way to say these things and get them off my chest, as it were, or out of my ears.
Yeah. I've made a few notes on your work, and the thing that comes up a lot is obviously politics, but it's the politics of listening and the politics of sound, and it's a way that I think is unique to your work and the way that you find that sound and politics are like never separated.
Yeah, I mean, I think for a long time there was a lot of literature and there was a lot of artworks that had sound as very kind of like ephemeral, intangible. People's obsession with sound was that, it was somehow, yeah, kind of like not part of the world. It was somehow ghostly, ethereal. It was treated as almost this this medium which was so far behind all of the thinking that had been done around the image, all of the political and aesthetic work that had been done around that. So for me, it was really, sorry, my daughter's come home now, she's shouting. I'm going to keep the door locked. She doesn't come in. Baba. Uh-oh, she's banging on the door. I don't know, hear that. This is a very walled, unwalled moment. I'm getting... Yes, Baba. I'm back on telephone.
She wants to come and talk, Art. Yeah. So you were saying you felt like sound has been overlooked, maybe, in what it is to look at art, what it is to experience art.
Yeah, I think people weren't ready to think with sound. And I think they're too busy thinking about sound. They weren't ready to sort of start to think about the world through and with sound. You know what I'm trying to say? That
yeah.
Sound could be a way that we could actually access differently or from another angle. The questions that I've been working with, which have to do with kind of the politics of memory and witnessing, and it is lacking in some ways, though I think counterintuitively it's lacking because we're so good at listening. I think often people think that it's lacking in discourse because we don't know how to talk about it. But I think we do so much kind of filtering with our ears. We're so good at it. We're so fast at kind of decoding language from other sounds. And I think that's, I always find it really interesting. You know, one of the most difficult things for computers was to understand that each one of us was not speaking our own completely different language because of how much kind of excess sound the voice gives to any given message, you know? So right now it would be like the three of us to a machine, it could not understand how that's one language for a long time. But we are so good at kind of like moving past all of the kind of excess information to get really direct to the kind of message in listening. And I think often that means we're kind of listening at the speed of sound. We don't think with sound. We don't stop. We don't kind of like think about its implications because it's so much part of the communicative process, right? So we're sort of so used to using it in this sort of one directional way. Whereas when you kind of pause on it, you listen to not only the voice but the silences, the pauses, a whole world of kind of like other messages start to emerge. One of the other points to that I find interesting is that, you know, I work a lot and think a lot about ear witnessing and how different witnesses have described sounds.
Well, let's talk about ear witnessing because I've just come across that because of your recent film, which is currently in the Turner Prize.
Yeah, me too, actually. It was the first time I'd really ever thought about it before.
Yeah, because you know eyewitness, you think an eyewitness, but to be an ear witness, I was like...
Although, actually, do you know what? There was one case which I was aware of, which was Oscar Pistorius.
Yes.
So when he obviously... that whole situation.
Apparently
with
he
his
shot his
girlfriend.
Wife
yeah.
girlfriend,
and there was all that talk of like banging on the door of the bathroom.
Yes.
And you know, the sounds that people heard and then the gunshot sounds
the
and all
shooting
that.
Of Reba
that was one of the first
Steenkamp,
times yeah. I'd ever thought about it. And in a way, what you're talking about, this idea that we've somehow overlooked sound, is very much to me something because I think it's so obvious somehow. Like sound is something that we all in a way just take for granted and don't think about.
Yeah.
And when you do go silent and start intellectualizing something and thinking about it in your brain, I never think about sound that much, apart from maybe with music when I listen to music. But I found that whole thing so interesting about ear witness reports. And then also the work you've done for Amnesty International. It's like, it's fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that was really the beginning of me thinking about it seriously because, you mentioned these cases that everybody knows, like Oscar Pistorius, like O.J. Simpson, like Michael Brown, Amanda Knox, all of these incredibly high-profile cases. And I'm very interested in working with them because they are in the popular consciousness. People can access that. But they haven't thought about it, like you say, they haven't thought about the role of sound in each of those cases. And really, what's interesting is that it sounds like a very niche thing that I'm talking about, the ear witness. And you, like you say, you'd never thought about that term before. But actually, in all of the most high-profile cases all over the world, in all of the most well-known legal cases, they often hinged on sound because sound, it functions differently, right, to images. And so when you're not supposed to see something, or when something happens behind closed doors, then that sound, of course, leaks outside of that context. So what I'm trying to say is that it sounds like a niche thing, but in fact, it's in legal terms, in legal cases, it's one of the most prevalent sources of evidence is actually ear witness testimony. And despite that, there isn't really a language to talk about it. There isn't really efficient ways to solicit the memories of ear witnesses. And so when I was asked by Amnesty International to interview the six survivors of Said Naya prison, based on what they'd heard, because they'd had such a limited visual experience of the prison in which they were held, I was looking for precedents for how to do these interviews, to do dedicated kind of ear witness interviews to really access their acoustic memories. And there was almost nothing. So that case, really, in the end, that work that I did with those witnesses...
What is the case, Lawrence? For our listeners, what was that case?
This is a case in Syria, wasn't it?
It was, yes. So Amnesty International were looking to do some advocacy for a prison that they had heard very horrible things about, a Syrian regime prison. Regime meaning the regime of Bashar al-Assad. And what had happened was people who had gone into that prison had been brought in blindfolded, had been brought to their cell, and the cells were dark. They had never left the cells for the majority of their time inside, sometimes 3 years just sitting in one room. And so that meant that the sounds coming into their cell were vital for them understanding what was going on. And when they would never have eye contact with the guards. Whenever a guard would come in, they'd have to face the wall. So really the whole experience of the guards, of the architecture of the place, of who was coming in and out, and all this vital information was sound-based. They'd committed it to their acoustic memories. Some of them, with incredible precision, had decided to really memorize every sound from that place. And it was my job then to kind of commit that sound to language, to work with them, to create interviews where we could really understand what it was they'd heard, and turn them away from just the kind of classic victim narrative to being their own kind of expert witnesses, to really mobilize their sensitivity that they had accrued from being in this highly terrible place. But they'd got such an acute sensitivity to sound that it was important to register that and to use that as a source of knowledge for what was happening inside that horrible place, for which no independent observer has been allowed access. So it's really, it was really an incredible thing to work on, not only because of how much the case went around the world, and it was the biggest Amnesty case in 2016. It was incredible to be part of something like that, but mostly it was incredible because I learned so much from those people. I mean, really, they really changed the way my brain worked, And that's, you know, I think it often gets misunderstood, but that kind of brain-changing thing that happened to me in that process, you know, what I thought going into those interviews and what I thought coming out of them was so completely different that's the kind of thing that I tried to work on with my art practice. I couldn't find another way of expressing what they'd taught me. And so the three works, Said Naya, The Missing 19 Decibels, After SFX, and The Ear Witness Inventory, and Walled Unwalled, are works that I then made in the subsequent 2 years to try and sort of like express that knowledge. And the knowledge was really around sort of what they taught me about the relation of sound to architecture, to violence, to human memory, to the voice also, to what is a voice, what is a whisper. Yeah.
And but you so didn't go into that as an artist. You went into it thinking it was going to just be, well, not just be, but an experience of Amnesty International to help these prisoners release what they experienced.
Yeah, that's right. I didn't go into it as an artist, but being that I am an artist, I couldn't not be an artist in that room. And what I mean by that is that those interviews were not, they're not legally admissible interviews. They work for advocacy because they pulled out a lot of information, but we were really collaborating in that space. You know, we were using sounds and tones and mouthing sounds with our mouths and using objects around us and playing sound effects from films to try and create a language for something that was essentially unspeakable. Sound, you can't really, there's not really a good vocabulary for it, especially in the precision that we needed to talk about it. And so really, for me, art is that thing which happens after language. It's a kind of romantic view of it, but it's one I hold dear, that if you can't say it, if you can't write it, then it needs a work. It needs needs another kind of experience. And that can involve, of course, text. It can involve, of course, sound. It can involve, of course, voice. But the what I try to do is use art to render things possible to be said, which cannot be said otherwise. And so that kind of idea of working beyond and past language to account for experiences that were sometimes really also at the very threshold of experience, at the very threshold of the senses, where memories bled into one another, you know, hunger made them hear sounds in different ways. And so I think if I was just a sound technician...
They would love you on radio dramas. You'd be incredible.
Right.
You'd be able to recreate anything.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, if I was just a technician, I think I would have come away thinking, well, a lot of this is unscientific, but the fact that I was ready to hear the distortions in their memories as well as their silences, as well as their whispers, that's what really art taught me, and it taught me how to listen in a very different way, and I think that's what I could bring to the table. So though I wasn't there as an artist, it was very important that Amnesty asked an artist, even though that's maybe not what they thought they were doing.
Yeah. Do you think, like, as other artists, they're visually creative, they see things in their mind's eye. Do you think you have a mind's ear? Can you actually hear things in your mind as a sound artist now?
I think what I try to do with a lot of my works is, even if they're videos, even if they're silent graphic works, they're trying to activate a sonic imagination of the viewer. So, you know, even in works like Conflicted Phonemes, it's just an image. It's not sound. But those works, I'm really trying to even with images, think sonically and have a sonic imagination for everything that I do and approach. And I hope that that's what gets activated in people's response.
What do you
so
mean
I'm really
sonic?
Working
sonic,
like what do
you mean
sound.
Sonic, though? What is sound?
Yeah, I mean just sound. Yeah, like an acoustic imagination, really. Like you said, like a mind's ear. So the collection of objects that I collected for the Chisenhale show, which is the Ear Witness inventory. So that's like 95 custom and customized and sourced objects that I've taken from different ear witness testimonies all over the world. So when a witness describes a sound using a sound effect or an object, I collect those objects, and I've got this
objects.
Huge collection.
Wow.
So I've got this kind of my own personal sound effects library that's not based from film or the radio drama, but it's based on the way that witnesses describe sounds particularly. And so what I was doing with that when I show the objects is I'm trying to activate a space for the audience between the kind of visual and the sonic and the sound and acoustic and the sonic. So, you know, you would see an egg, for example, but in the context of the stories and the narratives that I'm drawing out, you know that the egg isn't just an egg, right? It's not only the image of an egg, but you have to think of the egg kind of cracking, and you have to think about the event in which a witness in New Zealand kept continually repeating that the punch sounded like an egg cracking, right? And so you see a tray rack, a rack of trays on the floor, and it's that's an excerpt from Alistair Cook, you know, who did the Letters to America. He was describing the assassination of Bobby Kennedy, and he said that it didn't sound anything like a gunshot. It sounded like a rack of trays dropping to the ground. So what I want people to do is see these objects that are quite banal that they might associate visually from strange parts of their lives, the school canteen or their home kitchen, an egg. But
their
then
fridge, yeah.
But then I'm asking them to look at these mute objects and I'm asking them to hear them. You know, so it's really like what I'm trying to do is always activate the audience's acoustic imagination. And so a lot of the works, even if they're silent, I'm trying to work in the mind's ear of the audience, if you like.
To project a sound onto them.
That's actually the thing. When I saw your Turner Prize installation.
Congratulations, by the way.
Yeah, congratulations.
Turner Prize winner.
Yeah,
you're
a collective winner. But when I first saw that installation, I wasn't that familiar with your work. And it really shocked me, actually, because you made me stop in my tracks in the sense that you were making me look at the world in a different way, which I think is the point of art in many ways, to make us see things in a new light. And there was something so powerful. I actually went with my mum the first time, and my mum was so moved by your installation, because I don't think she'd ever thought about the world, you know, in the way that you were presenting it to us.
Orally.
Orally and through sound. And I was really also, I sort of left that thinking, God, it's almost so simple, and that's somehow its power, because it's something we're so familiar with.
Yeah.
But the
you take for granted things you're taking for granted. You're really highlighting.
Yeah, totally.
No, that's really good to hear. Thanks, guys. Yeah, I mean that's
no, it's amazing.
That is what I'm trying to do, and I'm you know, often people think and mistake it because it has a kind of like political level that it's somehow inaccessible or it's too. You know, if on first glance they might think it's very heavy, academic or something, but actually I'm trying to do the opposite. I'm trying to take things that are in the, you know, are quite simple, and I am trying to bring people on a journey that can be, you know, my mum, your mum, my grandmother. I am trying to speak to an audience, despite what it might at first look like. So yeah, I'm really glad to hear that.
Oh no, it's totally, totally accessible. So this prison that these prisoners came from, which is what the film in the Turner Prize currently is covering, does that prison still exist?
It does, yeah, it does.
So no one's gone in, been able to like, you know, like they, because I've got like forensic architecture is something that I guess you can umbrella for what you work in, and they worked out the architecture of the building through sound. Has anyone ever been able to go in there and actually see the building and realize that they were actually able, I guess, like a bat, to sonically like get an aerial view of the building that they were in, even though they couldn't really see it?
So I should have said that at the very beginning. Yeah, forensic architecture was who I worked with on doing. So I was leading the sound component of that investigation into Saydnaya Prison. So they're not two different things. Yeah, what I wanted to say is that it isn't quite like that, because we would imagine, you know, that maybe, you know, well, how can I say this? You know, some of the most some of the information that we uncovered through the sound was incredibly revealing, but a lot of the architectural details came from the fact that it's actually, as I speak about in World on World, it's actually a kind of archetype prison. Actually, we have one in Lebanon, Rumye. It's the same kind of triangle three design with this central stairway in the middle. That you know, that's similar to one that Pablo Escobar was in Colombia. So this prison is actually a DDR design. It got exported all over the world.
Right.
Particularly the kind of global south, the kind of,
so it's like,
you know,
the standard prison. That's what it is. You're going to build a prison, and that's what it's.
Yeah,
going
to be. You know, of the former East, it's quite standard, I would say. Mm-hmm. So they could derive a lot of the architecture from that. It's not that we could, you know, do a kind of Batman-like sonar thing of the prison. But what we could do, quite amazingly, through a couple of the witnesses, and particularly one, Salam, he had this incredible narrative that he had memorized the sound of each specific door in his wing. And a few of them had done this. So he memorized from the each how each hinge and each lock sounded distinct from the other. So that he could know.
Did his match up? Did his ear experience, his sound experience, match up to all the other prisoners who were in the same wing? Could they identify the same sounds?
No. So he had done this work quite independently from the others.
Right.
But what we could do is corroborate that with different information. And so what I wanted to say was that because he'd done that work, what he was doing it for was actually a kind of survival work, because he wanted to know which door the guards were opening at any one time. So if they opened one sound, he would say, okay, that's, you know, there, that's door number four, I'll call that number four. But in hindsight for us, when we were doing the investigation, what that was incredibly useful to do was to work out how many cells were actually being used in any wing at any given time. So he would say, okay, well, during this period, door eight hadn't been opened at all. So we could say, okay, that, you know, it's not always full all the
it's
time.
Empty.
We could start to we could start to work backwards to understand how many prison cells are being used. We could start to say, okay, the overcrowding is in fact an intentional violation. It's not that the prison itself is overcrowded. They want to stuff people in tiny rooms that are meant for solitary cells, use them for nine people. So these are kind of ways we could map out both the violations that are happening,
wow,
how many people are being held inside, and corroborate that with other evidence, and also understand, you know, where the guards were, the pattern of the guards in the day.
You could work out the cruelty of their regime by
exactly
the sounds of what cells are open. Wow. God.
And that's just one example. You know, you could also say, okay, how many food bowls were provided? So all these internal details about how little they were fed, about how many people were held inside, about how often new prisoners would come to the prison and be initiated and brought in.
Did it work? Did it work? Did it stand up in a court of law? Did this actually get proven against the cruelty? And did they get any sort of success from proving things from this? Did it work?
Well, in any, there has been no legal trial against Bashar al-Assad. If it is, these witnesses will be called, and this testimony will be put forward.
Even though now it's being used for advocacy reasons, it could actually be used in court at some point.
Right, as evidence.
Yeah, I mean, it would probably have to be re-performed and under different conditions, because as you might know, like, advocacy is quite different to the burden that, you know, of proof that evidence needs to pass through and the chain of custody and all that stuff. So advocacy is freer to use, you know, but it's very thorough work, because, you know, they interviewed, we did six ear witness interviews with six different former survivors, and then they had then gone on through the advocacy campaign to interview two or three defectors, so they could corroborate what the guards who were actually doing the torturing with the witnesses who'd came out. So they've been gathering this testimony, but Bashar al-Assad is still there.
Did it match up? Did it all match
up? Yeah, it matched up. Yeah, of course. Yeah,
wow.
and more, because, you know, what was really chilling in what they were telling us was things that hadn't come yet to bear. It would come out in December when they interviewed the defectors, and one of the guys kept telling me, you know, there was something going on. He said that they would take one cell, they would call names, and they would take them, and they would drive, and we'd hear the engine disappear. And we'd hear those same trucks come back. And that time wasn't long enough to release them, to take them back. But the trucks would come back empty. And he said, this is them executing. This is the sound of the trucks coming back empty. I'm sure it's execution. At the time, we couldn't say that in our initial report because we didn't know. Mm. We had no way to corroborate it. But we were alarmed to hear it. When the defectors came, they said, yeah, he's exactly right. We would drive them to a building just out of earshot. It was a building, what they came to be known as the White Building. The truck would just drive a little bit, take them there, and that's actually where the guards corroborated that that's where the executions would happen and the trucks would come back.
Yeah.
And it was actually hanging, and now we know.
Oh my God!
So even from that,
but like you say, they're taking it out.
They memorize the names.
So they're taking it out of people being able to hear. So they obviously know that, like, you know, hearing is a powerful resource in a sense.
I mean, in some ways, you think if they wanted to torture them, they would want you to hear. They would have wanted the victims, the kind of people to witness, to hear that experience.
Yeah, but
happening.
It might create too much hysteria, though, or something.
Do you think?
No, I mean, I think you're right, Russell, 100%, because that's one of the games that we were playing with that. You had to be mindful that some aspects of the terror that was happening there was meant to leak out for the Syrian people to know that this was the consequence of protesting, of blogging, of any kind of activism. Because in Saidnaya, torture is not used as a method to get information. It's used as a resonating chamber to be punitive for those people who had been protesting.
Punish. Yeah.
Yeah, who'd been protesting, you know. So they'd cleared the prison.
Make an example of these people.
Exactly. So in some level, what we were doing with our advocacy work was actually helping Bashar al-Assad's message. You could make that criticism. But on the other hand, on a global scale, the world had not known and was at that point almost ready to accept. Because remember, everyone at that point was, in 2016, was so obsessed with Daesh, with ISIS. And ISIS is a horrible and dreadful thing. But because of Islamophobia, it was also, you know, pumped up in the media, and no one was talking about what was actually happening in Syria and the real mass killings. It wasn't from Daesh, although Daesh are awful, but it was really happening, you know, from Bashar al-Assad, who's a, you know, secular guy. So you had to look at, you know, when we released the report, it actually had a big impact because people were ready to accept again Bashar al-Assad. And then that news came out, and, you know, France were key in sort of bringing that very quickly to their utmost attention and the world's attention, also on a diplomatic scale. So it was quite a crazy thing to be part of. And like I said, so yeah, I mean, that's all the stuff that came in the initial report. And that's all the stuff that inspired me to kind of, or really, like I said, sort of change the way I thought about a lot of things that I'd taken for granted.
Yeah.
And then you're
like an investigative journalist when it comes to this, but through sound. You're like and you're also then therefore becoming a storyteller through sound.
Yeah, definitely. And that's the power actually of your work, I think, is that you've obviously realised, which is also quite similar in a way to your other winners of the Turner Prize. Mm. I think each artist was very much looking at ways to bring about social change and also make people wake up a bit and, you know, look at the issues that are going on every day in the countries we live in, but also internationally. Mm. And
how did you get into sound art? How do you think you found that as your medium as an artist?
I wanted to talk about that as well. Can I quickly say something?
Yeah.
I was fascinated. When I left the Turner Prize installation by you,
yeah,
the first thing I thought was like, how did he do this? Like, because I would never have thought to sort of analyze it. And then you often think, oh, well, he's an artist, therefore he's looking at the world, you know, and that's his role or something. But I was really fascinated about you as a kid. And I started thinking about this idea of you being British because you grew up in England, but also the idea of your kind of like Lebanese roots and the kind of combination of those different histories in a way. But I was really interested in you as a kid. And I, the more I heard you speak, I was really fascinated by this idea of how from a very young age, you wanted to kind of break convention and that you were almost not someone that would just take something for granted and that you wouldn't just copy a sound. Instead, you wanted to break a sound and somehow like reinvent the way that you were recording sound or things like that. Can you speak a bit about that part of your childhood?
It's like a lot of people who grow up between places or a lot of immigrant experience, right? You are never comfortable in one place. Mm-hmm. You're always kind of like trying to match what you think in relation to, you know, what other people perhaps are more comfortable. You know, people are more kind of solid. They're on more solid foundations. Then they think more solidly. But I think when you come through another channel and you're always between things and never quite meet any one identity or position, then you're often find yourself questioning a lot of things, and it also, so from a young age, you know, my father is a crazy code switcher. So I think a lot of the works I do on The Voice, I really do, you know.
What do you mean a code switcher? Like Enigma or?
No, a code switcher is someone who changes their accent depending on who they're speaking to. So, you know, like, I don't know, my mum's like a basic code switcher. Like, she has a Yorkshire accent, but then when she wants to be like a bit posh, she puts a bit of a posh voice on. You know, it's like, that's like some basic shit. But my
and
dad,
that's called a code breaker. That would be a
code switcher.
Okay,
yeah,
I'm make a note.
You're switching codes.
Rob's a bit of a code switcher. When he's around me, he ends up trying to get more common.
No, I don't. I get more posh.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, this is Russell Tovey and Robert Diamond from Talk Arts, the arts podcast, and we're here today with Budweiser beer, and we're going to be talking about something very, very important to both of us, aren't we, Rob?
That's right. Budweiser, the king of beers, has joined forces with legendary artist Sir Peter Blake, the godfather of British pop art and someone that both of us have adored since we were kids.
I've loved pop art since I was a kid, and Sir Peter Blake has been a constant for me, alongside other pop art artists, the Americans like Andy Warhol, Roy Lichtenstein, Keith Haring. And I got into pop art, Rob, because I loved cartoons growing up. I mean, I still love animation. But suddenly I discovered that so many artists were referencing comic strips and cartoons in their artworks, and I could go and see them in museums, and I suddenly didn't need to grow up. And Sir Peter Blake was one of these artists that meant so much to me. And I think people, if they don't know the name Sir Peter Blake, you would certainly know his work. The album cover for The Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club, Oasis's Stop the Clocks. These are iconic art historical moments that this artist has actually been at the forefront of.
And you've met him, haven't you?
I've met him, at the South Bank Show Awards years ago. I was there for the History Boys, and he was there, and I got incredibly excited and met him. But you've not met him before, have you, Rob?
I have. I've actually even been to his house and hung out with him and his wife, and I got to make an amazing print with him, which was a huge privilege, actually. It was a real career moment for me. So Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake have come together to unite, and they have created an exclusive limited edition beer can, which doubles as a collectible piece of pop art.
And it was on display at London's Truerman Brewery on the 23rd and 24th of March this year, if you were lucky enough to get there. And also, were you one of the lucky few that were able to get one of the signed beer cans by Sir Peter Blake himself? And there was something very special there, wasn't there, Rob? What was that?
They've actually made the first ever fridge frame, which kind of is reminiscent of what we would be, you know, accustomed with in terms of a museum exhibit. Yeah. But this fridge frame is designed to display the limited edition can of beer as a work of art, but also keeps the beer cool.
Okay, I need a fridge full of fridge frames because this sounds incredible. So Peter Blake's work adorns the cans with all of his eye-catching simplicity. It features the Budweiser's iconic red bow tie logo, but it's encompassed by the artist's signature and his use of block colours and icons. They unveiled this artistic can in all of its glory in one of these fridge frames, as Rob said, which is very exciting. The limited edition cans are available to purchase as a four-pack for a limited time only in selected Tesco stores nationwide.
Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake, thank you for bringing us this cultural moment. I love it when art reaches new audiences, and I really feel like this is going to go into everyone's homes, and is really joyous. So head over to Tesco, pick up a four-pack. Thank you, Budweiser.
But also, if you want to get this collectible piece of art at home, Budweiser also giving people the chance to own their very own exclusive fridge frame. Beer and art lovers can register their interest by visiting www.budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. That's budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. Budweiser and Talk Art with Sir Peter Blake.
class
so,
anxiety.
So yeah, I mean, I think in the UK is a crazy place for that because the accents mean so much there, you know, if for such a small place.
Yeah, definitely.
Yes. I think that's really interesting. But, you know, also my dad, yeah, he takes on the identity. He's like a kind of chameleon. He takes on the vocal identity of anyone he's speaking to. So I think as a kid, that really influenced me because I sort of start going, all right, so you can be many things, you know, like the voice. It's not that it already broke my sense of kind of like the idea that your voice is who you are. Actually, your voice is constantly, you're making new identities with your voice. And I find that really liberating in my adult life. And like, you know, like you said, it makes you very aware of who and how you're speaking to and being spoken to. And,
totally.
Yeah.
I'm the same as an actor. I mean, for me, the voice and accents and dialect and everything is fundamentally one of the most important things it is to play a character.
And actually, it makes me think of like when I was younger, I was in a band and I went to live in Montreal in Canada for a while. And when I was young, you definitely get this kind of thing where you very quickly start to pick up the accent of the area you're in. Mm. Because I think subconsciously it must help you fit in or something
Well, it's a rhythm. I think when you go somewhere, you pick up a rhythm. Like if you go to Australia, everyone has that kind of like lilting upward inflection.
Yeah.
And I think if you spend time somewhere, you do like through osmosis, through the sound, pick that up and you rhythmically communicate with people. I know that I've done various things where I've worked with my British accent, but I'm in an American drama, and I always learn the lines in an American accent and then put my accent back on it. So, because rhythmically, it links in with everyone else's rhythm, so it doesn't feel it jars. Yeah, because so many times I've watched shows and I've heard it's been an American drama, then you hear a very British voice, and it seems to me, as a Brit, it jars.
Wow.
And I don't think the Americans notice that as much, but for me, it always jars. So I want, rhythmically, I am British, but I want to be able to just seamlessly link in with everyone else's tone.
So, Russell, I have a question for you. What do you think of Hugh Laurie in House, his American accent? As an actor.
Well, to begin with, I think Hugh Laurie is a phenomenon. And I think he's one of these actors that we are all still like, hang on a minute, what? Hugh Laurie is selling out Carnegie Hall doing like a jazz a concert,
and us,
we were like, he's like Jeeves and Worcester.
I know,
like,
exactly.
How has this happened?
He was our childhood.
And that happens all the time. I think, you know, like my mate James Corden is like in America. He's James Corden at the Late Late Show. He's a superstar, and I'm like, what? That's just James. How has this happened? But I think he's, spot on. I think it's incredible. I think it's inspiring.
I can't.
What do you think then? You think it's terrible?
I don't know. Maybe because I got used to. I don't know. I can never listen. I can always think that he's doing an accent. I never got. Like, that's why I could never watch House, because I was so used to him.
Oh,
being
so you
British.
Can't believe
exactly.
It.
Exactly. I know
you
it's
can't
hard.
Just
I know
fall
it's
into
hard.
It and
yeah.
believe it's real. You know, he's
and
acting.
I've asked Americans, and they've been like, oh, no, he's American. They never.
I know.
Knew it, right?
I know. Yeah. We take for granted what someone sounds like, which is what your work's about. And then suddenly they change what they sound like and you're like, hang on a minute, something's not right here.
So going back to your father, so if he was this code switcher and you were already at an age where you were being quite analytical, you've obviously got a very curious, investigative, kind of analytical mind in a way. But you then were really into music, weren't you, in your teenage years? And you studied music technology and sonic arts. And what I found interesting was I also studied music and I had friends that did music technology, but I don't feel like any of them speak about it the way you do. Like, you were really talking about like recording music and learning about it, but instead of just taking for granted what you're being taught, you always wanted to look on the other side. Like, do you think that's just who you are as a
almost
as a
like a producer who samples, who creates the actual music, who creates
definitely.
The track and the beats and everything. It feels like you look at music visually.
Yeah, I mean, I was really influenced by music. But yeah, particularly what was happening in Leeds, like the kind of DIY scene that was going on there, because that was very political also, but in a way that, you know, they were trying to do something very autonomous. They were trying to do something outside of the music industry.
Who were these artists? Who were these people? Who made
these,
it
there were there was
mainstream.
A group called there was a group a collective called Cops and Robbers, and they still exist. They do great work, and they had set up a zine that meant that they would promote only self-organized, not-for-profit gigs, and that meant that this zine was so popular that it meant that basically you would want to be in the zine. You had an incentive to be there because then people would come to your gigs. But that meant you'd have to be not-for-profit and you'd have to... So it kind of incentivized people to work in this very ethical and very cool way, which was better for the bands. It was better for the audience because they would pay nothing to come in, you know, like £3, all the music would go to the band. So anyway, it was enough that it got, you know, my brother was studying in Leeds. He brought me along to these gigs and they were just amazing. And that really changed both me understanding stuff politically because of that, what I just described, but also aesthetically, because then I would see stuff that was just crazy, you know. And before that, growing up in Jordan, I'd only had like MTV Asia, you know, so and that's not MTV, you know, Europe or US. I have to stress, MTV Asia was pretty bad. It was just like they would do like constantly Simple Minds Week. You know, you'd have like a week of them playing Simple Minds Week.
Wow.
Yeah, it was horrible. I remember traumatized by Simple Minds Week. I'll never forget that.
What is it like now when you hear Simple Minds? You have to turn it off.
I can't. No, I can't. Anytime I hear Simple Minds.
That's an audio related memory for sure.
That's trauma.
PTSD.
The thing is that, so what I'm trying to say is that that really did change the way I thought both about politics and also aesthetically about sound, and it really expanded my horizons for thinking about what a sound could be and how it could, you know, instead of sounding like Simple Minds, something could sound like crazy noise, and that could also be considered music. And that was a kind of amazing moment for me. So that was really a turning point. And you know what was... And then afterwards, we would play in bands, and I toured. I think our last tour was in 2012. Like, we would take all the time off studying or work just to tour around Europe, and we would be...
What were you called?
We were called Kleck Huddersfax, my band.
Say what? Kleck Huddersfax. What?
Yeah.
What does that mean? What did it come from? How did you come to that name?
It's just a stupid word. We just like the sound of the word. It's like a stupid word, but it means that it's like... Cleckheaton, Halifax, and Huddersfield. It's this triangle. Okay. They called the conurbation. They called Cleck Huddersfax in Yorkshire. Anyway, we're not. None of us are from there. We just thought the word was kind of stupid. Our friends were from there.
Right.
Anyway, so we called ourselves that, and we would just, you know, we would do that very passionately. And what was really fascinating, you know, this guy, I did an interview with Music Matters on Radio 3. Last month, and this guy asked me, he said, why is what you do not music? I thought, what a stupid question. You know, of course it's not music, it's a film, or it's an installation, or it's an image. So I can explain that to him, and he looked at me like, oh, this guy is not, like, he's also stupid. So we were looking at each other confounded, and he's like, no, what I mean is the rhythm, the way you use tension, the way you relate to the audience. He said that he feels it's extremely musical, that especially that idea of bringing a listener in, of you know, because in music, your relation to the audience is so much more direct than with visual art often. And I think that's the thing.
Well,
you're really
considering the audience. With music, you want your audience to be activated and be into the music. Whereas with visual art, it's like sometimes you make the work because you feel you're compelled to make it, and you don't really care about the audience in some ways.
Exactly. Yeah. Or you consider them a bit differently. And I think.
Yeah.
I'm very happy that I've gone. That music taught me that relation to audience, because I think that's what people have really attached to about the work.
It helps people to connect, doesn't it?
Yeah, because you know it's about intensities. You know, you when you're playing with music, you're playing with people in a, you know, in these different intensities. You want at some point you want them to reject it, to bring in you. You know, it's about modulating that experience of you in the room with those people, and there's something more direct about it that I really want to maintain at the core of the work. So. So that's all of that is to say, that a lot of this does come from music, and none of it comes from Simple Minds.
No, oh, that's a shame. Well, we won't let Simple Minds know that. Hopefully they feel like they've had some effect on your life.
Something I was really, something I really have taken away from your work is I started to consciously think about how in society we can be controlled or made to do things via sound. And it's something I'd never, ever thought about. And I started thinking about memory and sound. And when I was a kid, I grew up in a place very near Cookham in Berkshire. And I always remember the church bells, for example, and religion using sound. And when I went to Beirut a few years ago, and I think I thought of this obviously because you're living in Beirut and you're half Lebanese, but I really started remembering my experience in Beirut through sound, because often you would have like the call to prayer. And I remember being at the top of one of the famous hotels there, and we made a video of the experience, and you could see all the buildings, like the tops of all the buildings. I can't remember the name of the hotel, but it's like a kind of roof terrace bar. And it was during the call to prayer. And it was one of the most amazing sensual kind of experiences. And it was the highlight of my trip, linked to sound. And it started making me think about how religions use sound. And I don't just mean like hymns, but I mean that whole idea of like a call to prayer, or maybe like ringing the church bells to get people to go to church and all that kind of part of
carol singing.
Yeah, but that kind of control in a way, and the way that, you know, we can be led or directed through sound. And it's genuinely something I'd just taken for granted and never thought about. Is that something that you're aware of?
That is, the call to prayer is something I take for granted. But I think what is interesting in what you're saying is that you can use sound to create space and a communal space in ways that defy the way we normally think about space. You know, so you're sitting on top of a hotel listening to that. Someone else is sitting in the mosque. You know, so you're all in one kind of acoustic space. And I find that really interesting. Same with the church bell. It was all about, you know, it was all about the jurisdiction of a specific church, wasn't it? Like how far you could hear the bell ring was which church you should go to, kind of thing. Or your that was your kind of center, right? That's why they say bow bell.
So it's a sense of zoning through sound.
Yeah, kind of like right.
And I guess it does bring people together as well, doesn't it? Because it's a community thing in a sense.
Exactly.
And it's a positive as well. I don't mean it just as a negative at all. But I just found it quite interesting because I'd never really thought about memory and linking it to sound.
You know what's interesting? I mean, I try to stay away from also people saying one culture is more sonic or one culture is more acoustic, one culture is more, you know, sense. Attributing senses to different cultures is a bit tricky because, you know, it's been used also quite violently, you know, to say, okay, then the Europe is the rational place of the eye kind of thing, you know, in old colonial kind of idea. But, you know, what is quite interesting is whenever you watch films with Arabic subtitles, so you're watching an English film, a film in English, and whenever it says, look, right? So someone say, look here, right? Or look, you know, like he's trying to get the attention of someone. Mm-hmm. In Arabic, you always see the translation is listen, isma. So you'll say, and now look here, or like look, now look. You know the way we would use look in English as a way to say to get attention.
Yeah.
In Arabic, you say listen. So it is actually kind of funny because I always think about that, like those scenes in films. Probably some of your films, Russell. You'll have that same thing.
So the Arabic translation is always missing.
Well, I guess with your Yorkshire countryside, everyone was telling you to listen, to look, and whereas in the Arab world, they're telling you to listen, and that's where all of your work has come from.
Maybe you could get work backwards from that. Yeah,
that's a whole other thing, though. That's a whole other thing, isn't it? Because that's like translations, and then oh my god, that's a whole other
universe. Right, we're going to get onto where you're at now. You've just won collectively the Turner Prize 2019, which we've congratulated on, but we will congratulate you again. You're welcome. You're welcome. Very well deserved. How has this whole experience of being a Turner Prize nominee and now being a collective Turner Prize winner affected the life of Lawrence Abu Hamdan so far?
Well, you know, it's not, I think if I live in the UK, I'd have felt the impact more, but I kind of disappeared quite quickly afterwards. I did get spotted in a pub the next day, which was quite a weird experience.
Where? In Margate or in London?
No, in London, yeah. A random bar. Then, you know, that was quite funny because, you know, Well, you know, that can happen in, you know, art events, but you don't expect it to happen randomly. But it had, because of the decision we'd taken to do it a collective thing, that did make it spiral and go viral. And, you know, it did mean that our image circulated much more than would otherwise. And so I think, you know, for those days, it was quite, it was scary also because, you know, the trolls come out a bit as well, you know. You must know that, the kind of price of fame a little bit.
I'm but, sitting opposite, you know, one at the minute.
He's sat opposite a troll. I'm a troll.
When you say we made the decision to win the award collectively.
Yeah, so how does that
how
work?
How did you do that? How did you guys fundamentally make the decision own awards?
We interviewed Helen Kamerk recently in Walthamstow just before you all announced it. And she'd said that you had a WhatsApp group, which at the time was, we were very excited to discover.
Yeah.
But I'd also thought.
Do you want to know the name of the WhatsApp group?
Yeah, what?
The Winners.
Oh, really? The Winners?
The Winners.
The Winners. So you guys gave yourselves that name when you first got together because you knew that you were all winners. Oh my God.
Well, we even when we didn't know it, we were trying. We were really, you know, and hats off to the Tate and the jury for supporting that decision. You know, it's not that, I don't want to be, it sounds a bit arrogant to say that. And all I'm trying to say is that we had a will to do it and it was supported by the powers that be. And
the panel.
And they didn't have to do that, and they did it at risk to themselves. Also, you know, Alex Farquharson, you know, really did stick his neck out for that decision, and I really do appreciate that.
But how did you do? Did you like have to do a presentation as a group for
the
panel?
Didn't you write a letter? I thought they wrote a letter.
How did you go about convincing them that this was the right choice for them to make?
Well, you know, our argument was reasoned very much through the fact that when we saw it's not, you know, a lot of people say, well, why did you accept the nomination then? Well, we didn't know who the other artists were at the nomination. We didn't know the kind of works they would make. There's been many Turner Prizes where it's been extremely ununified collection of people who come from very different points of view. And we are very diverse as a group. But I think we take very seriously, you know, the art as a tool to make political claims. As you know, coming back to the very first thing I said at the beginning, that we use the language of art as an aesthetic tool to actually experiment with the ways in which we can say and partake in the politics of the world. So I think that was what was common between us. The practices are extremely different. Where we come from is extremely different. But there was this central commonality, and we felt that, you know, that needed to be taken seriously. That's what needed to take the stage, not any one single person. And we felt that that actually the way of judging between the four of us would undermine that. What was common between us, and it would sort of say, okay, well, this prison in Syria is more important than the role of women in Northern Ireland, for example, right?
In the struggle.
We thought, no, these things are inherently connected, and we all saw them as connected. And so it was really about making that statement too, that that you can't reduce us to just the prescience of the issues we're dealing with. We're also artists, and we're trying to use our work to show that these issues are entangled with the world, that they're really connected with them. And so we said that, you know, that would potentially the now that you've chosen this group of artists, we see a dilemma that the competition format is going to undermine the way that we work, and that one strand that goes between us. Because if there was just one artist who worked in that way, then a prize would celebrate that artist for working for trying to use art to modulate
an
intensity of an experience around a political issue. So
exactly. I think the show itself felt like a group show. The minute I got there, I was like, it's the first time the Turner Prize had ever felt like that to me.
Yeah.
And I think there are some people who were criticizing your decision for the reason that, oh, it's the end of the Turner Prize and it can never happen again. But I think they're completely missing the point, because there's never been a Turner Prize like this where all four nominees were so socially and politically engaged.
Yes.
And all had such a distinct...
And the current climate of where we're at politically in the world.
And had such a distinct message as well. Mm. And I think also beyond a political message, you know, by you guys unifying, I think it was also just that idea of trying to make people listen to each other. And okay, we might all disagree and have very different political
agendas.
Personal agendas, but I feel like I think it was a message to listen to each other, maybe.
Yeah, I think people who criticized it in general, I mean, of course, everyone's free to criticize it, that's fine, but I think if they'd seen the show, they would have got why we made that decision. I think it was very clear, and I think a lot of those people hadn't seen it. They just judged it on what, you know, we said. But that's really coming from our work, as you know, and our process. So if you like, and this is what I said before, if you like what we do as artists and you really like our work, you will get why we made that decision, and you will like that too in a way, or you'll understand it at least. So I think it really has to do with the work, and I think a lot of that has been overshadowed in the discussion, you know, and maybe that's one thing I regret, that now that's the thing that everyone wants to talk about rather than, you know, talk about the work, even though maybe we decided to do that so that the works would be put back in the forefront, not a single identity, not, you know. So anyway, but I think it's been interesting, the response, and I think there's enough backlash just for people to say, okay, well, it didn't work next year, we'll go back to it. It's not the end of the Turner Prize if there's a huge backlash against it, you know. Can just go back to what it was.
Has it changed your life and career trajectory since winning?
I mean, it's a bit early. It's only been a week or
a few weeks. Can you feel like a vibe has changed or has in like has become more, people have obviously become more aware of you and your work, and can you correlate that with like a surge of more interest in putting your shows on?
I mean, I think that had already happened with the nomination, to be honest. And I think that's what a lot of artists go through with the nomination. I think that's the nomination is the win, really. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
Whether or not they want to admit that or whatever. I mean, that would be what I would say to prizes like that, which bring a shortlist, you know, a really tight shortlist together, that really the nomination is the win. And so I'd already felt it from the opening and from the announcement of the nomination. And, you know, also it happened in a crazy week where it happened at the week Venice Biennial opened, and I was also participating in that. So I'd already felt a lot of that madness, but you know, the work is enough that people, you know, it's not going to be something that you still got to see it to get it. It's not going to be just a hype thing, you know. You got to sit with it, and you got to get what's going on before you want to put it in a show. You got to really, you know, you know what I mean. So it's not just going to be there's a load of hype and it just dissipates. So the work itself keeps it a bit grounded, you know. It doesn't spiral into everywhere, and you know, you see what I mean. It's not a banana taped to a wall.
And that's also why these prizes, you know, have a function and are necessary, because they do give people platforms to, you know, to be heard in a way they or be noticed maybe in a way that they weren't being before.
Yeah. Yeah, supportive. Is the WhatsApp group still going?
It is.
Jealous. Me and Rob are desperate to get into your WhatsApp group.
I saw Oscar Murillo in Miami last week, and he was saying, like, we are a collective, and I was wondering whether you would actually ever make work together, the four of you. Have you ever thought about that?
No, I think we're a collective for the moment that it needed to be a we needed to become a collective at this moment. So it wouldn't make sense to contrive something else from that. I mean, I think the show...
You're not going to take it on the road. You're not touring this collective.
I think the exhibition is a great exhibition, just as an exhibition, regardless or not. I think those four works work really well together. And I think I'd love to see that tour for sure. And I'd be glad. I'd be really glad for that. But as far as making works together, it would be quite different. Yeah. And it has to be said, we did not know each other before this exhibition. None of us had met. So it's
wonderful now that you have this bond and this special experience you've all been through. It must be that must be a win as
it's
well.
It's a bit like the X Factor.
Come in
as solo artists. You've all then done a band. You've had your greatest hits, and then you broke up again. You've all gone off as solo artists. It's One Direction.
So anyway, moving on from that very swiftly, we ask every guest who comes on two questions. One is, and you better get scared because this is serious investigative journalism.
Yeah,
but the first question we ask is, if you could take home any artwork and do an art heist and you could take an artwork home with you, what would you choose?
And why?
And why?
It's like a touchstone work of art.
Yeah. Well, the problem is a lot of the works that I love are from performance and...
Great.
But it would be hard to steal. It would be hard to nick.
Well, we can just we can help. Yeah. We'll find ways. We have vans and things. We can
Sadie Coles wanted the Gilbert and George performance.
Yeah, she did actually. She wanted the dancing. Gilbert and George.
What was it called?
One. The singing statues.
That's it. Yeah.
Oh yeah, that would be good. Well, you know who I don't know if you ever know this Alvin Lucier. I'm sitting in a room. This piece. I'd love to. Maybe it's not stealing, but I'd love to kind of, if I could steal a kind of...
experience.
Yeah, an experience. If I could steal some kind of time machine that would bring me back to when he first did that. I think it's such an incredible work on so many levels.
What is it?
I don't know if you... So the work is that he's...
What's his name? I didn't catch it.
He's called Alvin Lucier, and it's a very famous kind of like sound artwork of experimental music. He sat in a room and he read a script, said, I'm sitting in a room. And that would then be played back and recorded and re-recorded in the room. Until it happens so many times that all you hear is a kind of entanglement of his voice with the sound and the resonant frequencies of the reverberation of the room. Until you get this strange musical sonorous piece that's just developed out of the rhythm of him saying two or three lines. And what he says is, he says he has a stutter, and he says that he's doing this process in order to smooth out the stutters in his voice. And so it's a beautiful piece about the voice, about stutter, about vulnerability of speaking in public, about the relationship of our voices to the rooms in which we speak and resound, and the way we're inseparable from the space and one another. And I find it really one of the works that, you know, I'm really attached to, because it also mobilized a kind of scientific phenomenon in ways which I find fantastic, and use that for an experience of art.
When did you see this? When was this?
Oh, so this is like, for anyone interested in sound and sound art, it's one of the main pieces. It's really a touchstone work. But he has always worked in these ways, and I find his work amazing. I should really just Google now when I'm Sitting in a Room was first performed. It must have been in the 60s. Let's put that.
1961.
Okay, yeah. So it was 1961. He still performs it. Right. I actually saw him perform.
Oh, I see. I thought you'd experienced it. So your time machine would go back to 1961, so you can be in the room to experience it at the time.
So I'd steal the time machine first. That would be the nicking part. And then I'd just go there and then go back. The heist would be the time machine.
Amazing. Well, the other question we ask all of our guests is, what is your favorite color?
My favorite color is like a kind of tealy blue thing.
Nice. Turquoise. That was blue, actually Helen Kamuk. Helen Kamuk chose teal.
Did you ask Ty Shani and Oscar Murillo?
Not yet. We're interviewing Ty very soon.
Yeah.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
Imagine are a collective.
Imagine if all the WhatsApp winners had teal as their favourite colour and they didn't know. That'd be incredible. I've got one more question for you, and it might be a bit crude, but I think it's something that a lot of people question when it comes to sound art. As an artist, this is your life, this is your career, this is how you make your money. How do you monetize sound art? So for our listeners, it's like, how do you make a living and able to feed your family and pay your mortgage and everything through creating sound art?
Well, a lot of it comes from commissions and, working specifically on projects that you would be commissioned to do for museums. But also some, a lot of it in the late years come from acquisitions. So museums collecting the works and with the big support of galleries getting, people interested in the work that you do precisely for its prescience, its aesthetic, it's pushing the boundaries of specific the challenges to collecting it often is something that people are attached to and get people interested in how they can acquire and collect it. So I find it, it's just very similar to how many artists do it. But now we're in a very different world where things can be archived and collected and digitized, and artworks can exist in many different formats. So we're not just so limited to people drawing and the things that the ways that art became monetized before. It's very similar to the other artists. Yeah.
I also feel in the last decade or so, there's been such a growth in the open-mindedness of collectors. I mean, like private collectors who are actually up now for investing and collecting works that are very different to what, was historically collected. Mm. And there's certain collectors there's one in London even who just collects video art or people that will want to collect sound art or installations and people are being much more adventurous. And that's also why we're in a great time, for art. And
has your work been acquired from the Turner Prize?
It had before. Yeah, World on World had, but it's three works, so it's different. I mean, After SFX is yet to be part of a museum collection or something like that. But I wanted to just add to what you just said, because it's like one of the greatest conversations I'd had about my work, about World on World specifically, the video piece, was with one of the people who acquired it. He's called Murray Abramson, a collector from the US. And he's actually a neurosurgeon, scientist. And it was fascinating because he had this whole relation to the work. So the work is all about, in the work, it's these stories about sound bleeding through walls and how walls, in the work, walls keep becoming solid and then get broken down and solid and broken down. And that's kind of how I'm working with the choreography of the work, how the work plays out. And he said, oh, this is exactly what happens in the brain with the specific cell walls and how at some point they have to let certain proteins in and eject others. And he had this whole reading of the work through the kind of cell walls that happen internal to the brain. And it was one of the most beautiful things you could see someone do with the work, because he was so invested in it intellectually. His someone I had much great respect for what he does also, and how the contribution he's making to kind of neurological and everything like that. And it's just fascinating the kind of, so I think there's a perception of collectors, which is quite wrong. And I think sometimes when you, sometimes you can have a really kind of like brain changing conversation with people and they really do come from a very different place to the works than often curators do, which is more akin to the way artists think and practice. So it's been really fascinating, that side of things. So I just wanted to
I guess it challenges the experiences of what it is to look at art. When you see it from a perspective like that, it really...
And also, I think it helps people see their own lives or their own existence in a new light as well, which is a really magical, rare gift in a way. That's why art's so great. That's why I love it.
We love you, Lawrence. What's next for you?
Oh, thank you. What's next for me? Well, I've got a piece in the Sydney Biennial coming up.
Congratulations, that's exciting.
March. And then quite a lot of existing work in shows going on around and about these next few months. So you can catch it around and about. I can't think off the top of my head where right now, but it's coming to a town near you, yeah, I hope.
Okay.
Well, thank you so much for coming on Talk Art. It's been such a privilege to speak with you. And it's actually been quite an intense experience because we've never done a telephone interview like this before. And I think it's very apt for everything that you're
a
sound artist. Yeah. And it's, we've been very attentively listening.
Yes.
It's been wonderful to speak.
Yes. Thank you so much, guys. Amazing. This was great. Yeah,
thanks for coming on. And for everyone listening, there will be images coming up on the Talk Art Instagram page. Have you got Instagram page, Lawrence?
Yeah, I do.
What is it?
It's just at Lawrence Abu Hamdan, my name. LAWRENCE. Yeah.
So you can follow Lawrence at Instagram and also see images of his work at our Instagram at Talk Art.
And thank you very much.
And we'll be back very soon. That was such a global international episode. Woo! I loved it. London to Beirut.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Lawrence.
You. Cheers.
Bye.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diament and Russell Tovey. Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in this episode. Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever you get your podcasts.